Good afternoon, and welcome to another episode of In the Garden, right here on KFSK. I'm your host, Daniel Rowan Tucker. On this show, we dig our hands in the dirt, get back to nature, and find that special place of abundance and beauty. It's been a wild weather week, and if I said we've seen and heard enough about the S word, I think you'd know what I mean. So in case this particular late cold spring is getting you down and making you wonder what you're doing in Alaska, today I'm going to share a newcomer's view of this place and its weather. What follows is a passage from John Muir's classic book, Travels in Alaska, recounting his time in our region beginning in 1879. I hope that Muir's poetical vignettes of our damp climate will help you find patience with the slow onset of spring this year and look for the silver linings in our cloudy atmosphere. I have found southeastern Alaska a good, healthy country to live in. The climate of the islands and shores of the mainland is remarkably bland and temperate, and free from extremes of either heat or cold throughout the year. It is rainy, however. This rainy weather is of good quality, the best of the kind I ever experienced. Mild in temperature, mostly gentle in its fall, filling the fountains of the rivers and keeping the whole land fresh and fruitful, while anything more delightful than the shining weather in the midst of the rain, the great round sun days of July and August, may hardly be found anywhere north or south. An Alaskan summer day is a day without night. In the far north, at Point Barrow, the sun does not set for weeks, and even here in southeastern Alaska, it is only a few degrees below the horizon at its lowest point, and the topmost colors of the sunset blend with those of the sunrise, leaving no gap of darkness between. Midnight is only a low noon, the middle point of the gloaming. The thin clouds that are almost always present are then colored yellow and red, making a striking advertisement of the sun's progress beneath the horizon. The day opens slowly. The low arc of light steals around to the northeastward with gradual increase of height and span and intensity of tone, and when at length the sun appears, it is without much of that stirring impressive pomp of flashing, awakening, triumphant energy, suggestive of Bible imagery, a bridegroom coming out of his chamber and rejoicing like a strong man to run a race. The red clouds with yellow edges dissolve in hazy dimness. The islands, with grayish-white ruffs of mist about them, cast ill-defined shadows on the glistening waters, and the whole down-bending firmament becomes pearl-gray. For 3 or 4 hours after sunrise, there is nothing especially impressive in the landscape. The sun, though seemingly unclouded, may almost be looked in the face, and the islands and mountains, with their wealth of woods and snow and varied beauty of architecture, seem comparatively sleepy and uncommunicative. As the day advances toward high noon, the sun flood streaming through the damp atmosphere lights the water levels and the sky to glowing silver. Brightly play the ripples about the bushy edges of the islands and on the plume-shaped streaks between them, ruffled by gentle passing wind currents. The warm air throbs and makes itself felt as a life-giving, energizing ocean, embracing all the landscape, quickening the imagination, and bringing to mind the life and motion about us, the tides, the rivers, the flood of light streaming through the satiny sky, the marvelous abundance of fishes feeding in the lower ocean, the misty flocks of insects in the air, wild sheep and goats on 1,000 grassy ridges, beaver and mink far back on many a rushing stream, Indians floating and basking along the shores, leaves and crystals drinking the sunbeams, and glaciers on the mountains, making valleys and basins for new rivers and lakes and fertile beds of soil. Through the afternoon, all the way down to the sunset, the day grows in beauty. The light seems to thicken and become yet more generously fruitful, without losing its soft, mellow brightness. Everything seems to settle into conscious repose. The winds breathe gently or are wholly at rest. The few clouds visible are downy and luminous and combed out fine on the edges. Gulls here and there, winnowing the air on easy wing, are brought into striking relief, and every stroke of the paddles of Indian hunters in their canoes is told by a quick glancing flash. Bird choirs in the grove are scarce heard as they sweeten the brooding stillness, and the sky, land, and water meet and blend in one inseparable scene of enchantment. Then comes the sunset with its purple and gold, not a narrow arch on the horizon, but oftentimes filling all the sky. The level cloud bars usually present are fired on the edges, and the spaces of clear sky between them are greenish-yellow or pale amber, while the orderly flocks of small overlapping clouds, often seen higher up, are mostly touched with crimson like the outleaning sprays of maple groves in the beginning of an eastern Indian summer. Soft, mellow purple flushes the sky to the zenith and fills the air, fairly steeping and transfiguring the islands and making all the water look like wine. After the sun goes down, the glowing gold vanishes, but because it descends on a curve nearly in the same plane with the horizon, the glowing portion of the display lasts much longer than in more southern latitudes, while the upper colors, with gradually lessening intensity of tone, sweep around to the north, gradually increase to the eastward, and unite with those of the morning. The most extravagantly colored of all the sunsets I have yet seen in Alaska was one I enjoyed on the voyage from Portland to Wrangell, when we were in the midst of one of the most thickly islanded parts of the Alexander Archipelago. The day had been showery, but late in the afternoon the clouds melted away from the west, all save a few that settled down in narrow level bars near the horizon. The evening was calm, and the sunset colors came on gradually, increasing in extent and richness of tone by slow degrees, as if requiring more time than usual to ripen. At a height of about 30 degrees there was a heavy cloud bank, deeply reddened on its lower edge and the projecting parts of its face. Below this were three horizontal belts of purple edged with gold, while a vividly defined, spreading fan of flame streamed upward across the purple bars and faded in a feather edge of dull red. But beautiful and impressive as this was, this painting on the sky, the most novel and exciting effect was in the body of the atmosphere itself, which, laden with moisture, became one mass of color, a fine, translucent purple haze in which the islands with softened outlines seemed to float, while a dense red ring lay round the base of each of them as a fitting border. The peaks, too, in the distance, and the snowfields and glaciers and fleecy rolls of mist that lay in the hollows were flushed with a deep, rosy alpenglow of ineffable loveliness. Everything near and far, even the ship, was comprehended in the glorious picture and the general color effect. The mission divines we had aboard seemed, then, to be truly divine as they gazed transfigured in the celestial glory. So also seemed our bluff, storm-fighting old captain, and his tarry sailors and all. About one-third of the summer days I spent in the Wrangell region were cloudy, with very little or no rain, one-third decidedly rainy, and one-third clear. According to a record kept here of 147 days beginning May 17th of that year, there were 65 on which rain fell, 43 cloudy with no rain, and 39 clear. In June, rain fell on 18 days, in July, 8 days, in August, 15 days, in September, 20 days. But on some of these days there was only a few minutes' rain, light showers scarce enough to count, while as a general thing the rain fell so gently and the temperature was so mild, very few of them could be called stormy or dismal. Even the bleakest, most bedraggled of them all usually had a flush of late or early color to cheer them, or some white illumination about the noon hours. I never before saw so much rain fall with so little noise. None of the summer winds make roaring storms, and thunder is seldom heard. I heard none at all. This wet, misty weather seems perfectly healthful. There is no mildew in the houses, as far as I have seen, nor any tendency toward moldiness in nooks hidden from the sun, and neither among the people nor the plants do we find anything flabby or dropsical. In September, clear days were rare. More than three-fourths of them were either decidedly cloudy or rainy, and the rains of this month were, with one wild exception, only moderately heavy, and the clouds between showers drooped and crawled in a ragged, unsettled way without betraying hints of violence, such as one often sees in the gestures of mountain storm clouds. July was the brightest month of the summer, with 14 days of sunshine, six of them in uninterrupted succession, with a temperature at 7 a.m. of about 60 degrees, at 12, 70 degrees. The average 7 a.m. temperature for June was 54.3 degrees. The average 7 a.m. temperature for July was 55.3 degrees at noon. At noon, the average temperature was 61.45 degrees. The average 7 a.m. temperature for August was 54.12 degrees. At noon, 61.48 degrees. The average 7 a.m. temperature for September was 52 degrees, and at noon, 56 degrees. The highest temperature observed here during the summer was 76 degrees. The most remarkable characteristic of this summer weather, even the brightest of it, is the velvet softness of the atmosphere. On the mountains of California, throughout the greater part of the year, the presence of an atmosphere is hardly recognized, and the thin, white, bodiless light of the morning comes to the peaks and glaciers as a pure spiritual essence, the most impressive of all the terrestrial manifestations of God. The clearest of Alaskan air is always appreciably substantial, so much so that it would seem as if one might test its quality by rubbing it between the thumb and finger. I never before saw summer days so white and so full of subdued luster. The winter storms, up to the end of December when I left Wrangell, were mostly rain at a temperature of 35 or 40 degrees, with strong winds, which sometimes roughly lash the shores and carry scud far into the woods. The long nights are then gloomy enough, and the value of snug homes with crackling yellow cedar fires may be finely appreciated. Snow falls frequently, but never to any great depth or to lie long. It is said that only once since the settlement of Fort Wrangell has the ground been covered to a depth of 4 feet. The mercury seldom falls more than 5 or 6 degrees below the freezing point, unless the wind blows steadily from the mainland. Back from the coast, however, beyond the mountains, the winter months are very cold. On the Stikine River at Glenora, less than 1,000 feet above the level of the sea, a temperature of from 30 to 40 degrees below zero is not uncommon. After we had passed through the Wrangell Narrows, the mountains of the mainland came in full view, gloriously arrayed in snow and ice. Some of the largest and most river-like of the glaciers flowing through wide, high-walled valleys like Yosemite, their sources far back and concealed, others in plain sight, from their highest fountains to the level of the sea. Cares of every kind were quickly forgotten, and though the Cassiar engines soon began to wheeze and sigh with doleful solemnity, suggesting coming trouble, we were too happy to mind them. Every face glowed with natural love of wild beauty. The islands were seen in long perspective, their forests dark green in the foreground, with varying tones of blue growing more and more tender in the distance, bays full of hazy shadows, graduating into open, silvery fields of light, and lofty headlands with fine arching insteps dipping their feet in the shining water. But every eye was turned to the mountains. Forgotten now were the Chilcats and missions, while the word of God was being read in those majestic hieroglyphics blazoned along the sky. The earnest, childish wonderment with which this glorious page of nature's Bible was contemplated was delightful to see. All evinced eager desire to learn. We came to anchor in a beautiful bay. and as the long northern day had still hours of good light to offer, I gladly embraced the opportunity to go ashore to see the rocks and plants. One of the Indians, employed as a deckhand on the steamer, landed me at the mouth of a stream. The tide was low, exposing a luxuriant growth of algae, which sent up a fine, fresh sea smell. The shingle was composed of slate, quartz, and granite, named in the order of abundance. The first land plant met was a tall grass, 9 feet high, forming a meadow-like margin in front of the forest. Pushing my way well back into the forest, I found it composed almost entirely of spruce and two hemlocks, with a few specimens of yellow cypress. The ferns were developed in remarkable beauty and size, aspidiums, one of which is about 6 feet high, Ewoodsia, Iomaria, and several species of polypodium. The underbrush is chiefly alder, rubus, ledum, three species of vaccinium, and Echinopanax horrida, the whole about from 6 to 8 feet high, and in some places closely intertangled and hard to penetrate. On the opener spots, beneath the trees, the ground is covered to a depth of 2 or 3 feet with mosses of indescribable freshness and beauty. A few dwarf conifers, often planted on their rich, furred bosses, together with pyrola, coptis, and Solomon seal. The tallest of the trees are about 150 feet high, with a diameter of about 4 or 5 feet, their branches mingling together and making a perfect shade. As the twilight began to fall, I sat down on the mossy instep of a spruce. Not a bush or tree was moving. Every leaf seemed hushed in brooding repose. One bird, a thrush, embroidered the silence with cheery notes, making the solitude familiar and sweet, while the solemn monotone of the stream sifting through the woods seemed like the very voice of God, humanized, terrestrialized, and entering one's heart as to prepare a home for it. Go where we will, all the world over, we seem to have been there before. The stream was bridged at short intervals with picturesque, moss-embossed logs, and the trees on its banks, leaning over from side to side, made high, embowering arches. The log bridge I crossed was, I think, the most beautiful of the kind I ever saw. The massive log is plushed to a depth of 6 inches or more, with mosses of 3 or 4 species, their different tones of yellow shading finely into each other, while their delicate fronded branches and foliage lie in exquisite order, inclining outward and down the sides, in rich, furred, clasping sheets, overlapping and felted together until the required thickness is attained. The pedicels and spore cases give a purplish tinge, and the whole bridge is enriched with ferns and a row of small seedling trees and currant bushes with colored leaves, every one of which seems to have been culled from the woods for this special use, so perfectly do they harmonize in size, shape, and color with the mossy cover, the width of the span, and the luxuriant, brushy abutments. And here we end our visit with old John Muir today. Perhaps his flowery descriptions of our little neck of the woods will help us find new appreciation for the unique beauty of the place where we live, even when the spring warmth we long for seems painfully slow to arrive. That's all for this week. Thanks for joining me for another episode of In the Garden, right here on KFSK.